This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a welfare rights leader rallies to support the poor people of mostly Black Benton Harbor, Michigan. The financial board overseeing Puerto Rico is trying to divert disaster aid money to satisfy a debt to the bankers. A Black bookstore in Harlem, still standing. And Mumia Abu-Jamal says Donald Trump is crowning himself king.
But first, Kashama Sawant, the Socialist Alternative Party leader who serves on the city council in Seattle, Washington, is being sued for defamation by two city cops. Sawant called the police killing of an unarmed Black man a brutal murder. Defending against such suits costs a lot of money. Emerson Johnson is part of the Kashama Solidarity campaign. He says the cops' suit is an effort to silence opponents of police lawlessness.
Back in 2016, two police officers were patrolling a neighborhood. They saw Shea Taylor, who was out on parole. They claimed that he had a gun on him, which is why they approached the car. And what then happened was Shea never shot, but they shot Shea and resulted in Shea Taylor's death. In response to that, there was a large protest movement, and Kashama Sawant, Councilmember Kashama Sawant from Seattle, came out in response and told the crowd who had gathered at City Hall that the police needed to be held accountable for their actions. And since then, the two police officers who shot Shea Taylor have come out and said that Kashama has defamed them. So they put forward this defamation lawsuit in response to her holding them accountable. And I think, you know, we have to look at that as these two men had their feelings hurt. Another man, Shea, lost his life. So these are two very different things going on here.
Yes, Shea Taylor was hit by, I believe, 7 of the shots. The cops were never charged. They were never charged by the district attorney.
That's absolutely true. And I think that in situations like this, we're launching this campaign because so often we see that these cops are never indicted. And instead, they want to punish the activists who come out in response to these unlawful killings. And so what we see is that this is a really clear-cut example of them trying to intimidate and silence movements. And Socialist Alternative, the party that Kashama belongs to, builds movement. And Kashama is an individual within these movements, but she's also a prominent one, which I think is in particular why the police officers are going after her. And they want to say, you know, we're going to set an example. If you speak out against these racist killings, we're coming for you. And if the police are successful with this lawsuit, it's going to set a very chilling effect on activists and set a precedent, too, for more punitive measures like this to happen in the future. And it's important to point out that this isn't the first time that we've seen tactics like this being taken by the police and the political establishment. You know, we saw this in response to the police shooting in Ferguson. The activists were drawn through the courts because of their protest actions. But those stories mostly went unheard. But because Kashama has a platform, we want to use that to be able to elevate this story and draw a line in the sand and say, no, we refuse these tactics of silencing and intimidating movements, and that actually movements and individuals have a right and a responsibility to speak out against injustice, and we won't be punished for that.
Yes, Kashama Sawant and her Socialist Alternative Party were elected based on a campaign that included opposition to police abuse of citizens. And if she can't act in that way in service to the citizens who elected her, what is the point?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's a really important point, is that we're talking about a elected official who is elected on a platform that is about protecting the rights of working and oppressed people in Seattle and advocating for that. And we have so few politicians who run on an independent platform where they aren't beholden to big business, the political establishment, the police, and instead are actually responding to the needs of the movement. And we need more politicians like that who are independent socialists who can go and speak out against police brutality and speak out against racism and police violence with an unabashed and bold program on how to actually defeat it. But the thing is, with dissenting speech, it threatens the basis for capitalism. It threatens racism and sexism, which are necessary evils for capitalism to persist. And that's why we're seeing these silencing tactics against her rather than against free speech right-wingers who go out, and we see them instead being granted free speech spaces on campuses or protection by the police. Because at the end of the day, the things that they're speaking against reinforce capitalism. You know, they're spewing sexist, racist rhetoric that just reinforces the system we already have. Whereas Sharma, an elected official who was elected to hold these people to account, is challenging these pillars of capitalism by calling out racism and sexism and other injustices when she sees them.
Now, the city attorney did stick by Kashama Sawant and her right to have her position defended by the city. They ruled that elected representatives have to have the right and power to zealously advocate for policy proposals, that is, to do their political duty for which they were elected.
Yes, absolutely. This is her political duty. I think that they're is a misunderstanding that she was somehow acting outside of the realm of her job. We see this right now with the establishment media. They're trying to spin these lawsuits as though Sharma was doing something completely inappropriate or outside of her job title, and that we should see this as just some person who's angry and keeps spewing anger, and that this was a normal thing to have it go through a lawsuit. But it's not normal. This is completely inappropriate. What she was doing was right in line with her job, which is protecting and fighting for the people in this community that elected her. And a lot of the time that looks like standing up to police violence, standing up to exploitative landlords, or most recently in Seattle, standing up to Amazon. And it's entirely inappropriate for people to come after her and try and sue her for that.
Yes, there are plenty of deep pockets around that are willing to back up the police and in very expensive suits that could bleed dissident opinion dry, including that landlord that you talked about. He was compelled to drop his suit against Kashama Sawant.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's an incredible victory for us. Carl Hagelin, who is an exploitive landlord here in Seattle, Socialist Alternative and Sharma Sawant's office organized against Carl Hagelin because he has a propensity of buying buildings that are mostly immigrant black and brown families who he thinks he can exploit. And he has them living in terrible living conditions, cockroaches, rats, mold. And he tried to raise the rent on this building almost up to 100% rental increases. And that's completely unacceptable, to have people living in squalor and then increase their rent without doing anything to improve their living conditions. And so they contacted Sharma Sawant's office, and Sharma Sawant and Socialist Alternative helped them to organize to defeat those rental increases. And then Sharma was able to actually pass a law in city council, which was dubbed the Carl Hagelin Bill, the name of the exploitative landlord, saying that if you have outstanding rental or code discrepancies, if there are issues, then you can't raise the rent in those buildings. And as a result, Carl Hagelin took offense to that. He took offense to someone holding him accountable to his actions, and he filed this lawsuit. But ultimately, when it went to court, You know, when he claimed defamation in court, it didn't add up. There was nothing that actually proved that he had been defamed. Instead, what the courts decided, and, you know, what we believe as well, is that ultimately, Sharma was doing her job. She was acting as an elected official to represent the needs of her constituents and fight for these people against this exploitative landlord.
What's the status of the cop suit against Kashama Sawant? And what's the status of Shea Taylor's family, his survivors' legal actions, if any, against the police?
Currently, with the police suit, we're actually just sort of in a waiting period until it goes to court. They have filed a complaint against Sharma and the city of Seattle. We are now waiting for the next steps in the legal process of that. Obviously, I think what we really need to start doing, though, is saying that we aren't going to allow for these sorts of tactics to continue against activists. And that we also need a bold and unbowed movement against racism, which is what Shea Taylor's family has been embodying in their work since the shooting of Shea Taylor. Andre Taylor, the brother of Shea Taylor, is an incredible activist who recently in Washington State was able to get legislation passed against police brutality. So he's been using this platform that he's generated as a way to enact change, which is fantastic. I think that that is a necessary step that we need in this movement. Also, Shea's family is bringing forward a lawsuit of their own against the police for impinging on Shea's First Amendment right. During the police shooting, he was given conflicting orders about putting his hands in the air and getting down on the ground. He complied. The jury found that he complied with these orders and yet was still shot. So the family is bringing forward a lawsuit in response to that because this is inappropriate, this behavior by the cops. You know, this was a racist killing by the cops that could have been prevented if they had not, one, taken out their guns, but also not given conflicting orders to this person.
Yes, it seems that police across the country have a policy of comply or die. And in this case, the gentleman complied and still died.
Right, exactly. And that's unacceptable. We can't have that happening in the U.S. And that's why we need to be able to have activists and individuals and communities that speak out against this. That's completely unacceptable that the police can have this comply or die mentality. And what we need is we need bold movements that combat that and fight back against that. But we can't have that if these movements are being squashed in the courts, being drawn through trials that, you know, exhaust us with legal fees, with energy, and make it impossible to build the movements necessary to combat systemic racism, to put an end to police violence.
On the national scene, just recently, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a bill that effectively makes police a protected class, right up there with race and religion and gender. And any assault on police, according to this bill, should be treated as a hate crime. So the police are becoming even more protected against the rest of us.
The police are already protected. We see this in the ways in which grand juries never indict killer police officers, yet they try to punish activists, right? They come after people who don't have these sorts of protections and draw them through the courts, whereas instead our broken criminal justice system goes out and maintains and extends the protections put forward on police officers. And we need to be able to challenge that. We need to be able to push back against that. But we also need to be able to do that without fear of retaliation and intimidation by those same forces.
Now, Kashama Sawant was successful in terms of getting the support of the city in having the city take up the cost of her defense. But for the rest of us, for people like Shea Taylor's brother, they can be charged by these police with defamation for saying that my brother was killed by these guys.
Right. And I think the city taking up Shama's legal defense fees is very important because she was acting within the scope of her job as an elected representative. And with other activists who are being sued, it's completely unacceptable that the political establishment, that police officers, that right-wing forces can drag these activists through the courts, costing them an egregious amount of legal fees, exhausting them of their energy, just because they had dissenting speech. But I think this narrative around legal fees is really interesting as well, because here in Seattle, the Seattle Times, which is one of the most prominent media outlets here, an establishment media outlet, to be clear, has taken to focusing on reporting on the cost of Shama's legal fees rather than the fact that this is a lawsuit about someone speaking out against injustice, and said they want to make the narrative about how much this is costing or supposedly costing taxpayers, when in fact the police and this exploitative landlord, Carl Hagelin, were the ones who made the decision to bring forward these lawsuits. And that in reality, it is our responsibility as activists and community members to speak out against these injustices whenever we see it. And we should not be having to pay legal fees in response to that. And that these things should be a normal and accepted and necessary part of holding our politicians and our police officers and our landlords to account for their actions.
And of course, the point of these suits is not just financial intimidation, but to politically isolate the dissident politician.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I think these are very clear-cut examples of intimidating and silencing tactics. I think there's a very similar thing going on right now that we see in the NFL, right? You know, Colin Kaepernick was protesting against racism and police violence, and he's now been effectively blackballed from the league. And now the league has escalated that tactic by saying that they're going to fine anyone who comes out on the field and protests. So these tactics of intimidation and silencing are not new. It's part of what the political establishment with the police need to do in order to maintain order under capitalism, because racism is a necessary part of capitalism. And so any challenge to that has to be squashed and silent.
And the way to fight organized capital is to organize?
The way to fight organized capital is to organize movements. You know, we need massive movements of ordinary people coming out into the street and saying, no, we refuse to accept this. And that's why we launched the Shama Solidarity Campaign, is that we need people to turn out and say, when we speak out against police brutality and racism, we need a large movement behind us saying that they agree and that we refuse to be silenced and that we refuse to be intimidated for holding these views. You know, this campaign is a grassroots campaign. We're running it through independent individuals and community members that believe we need to protect dissenting voices, but also to have a bold and unbound movement against racism and police violence. And we aren't taking any money from corporate donors. We're doing this by ourselves. And so we have a solidarity fund on our Facebook page. You can find it, Trauma Solidarity Campaign on Facebook. If you donate to our solidarity fund, that will go toward helping us to build this movement. And any of those donations are greatly, greatly appreciated.
That was Emerson Johnson of the Kashama Sawant Solidarity Committee in Seattle.
The powers that control mostly black Benton Harbor, Michigan, were overjoyed when local activist Reverend Edward Pinckney was sent to prison for 30 months for allegedly tampering with election petitions. But a higher court later exonerated Pinckney of all charges. Within weeks, Pinckney was leading protests against the Whirlpool Corporation, which has dominated Benton Harbor's politics for decades, and against Whirlpool's pet project, the PGA Senior Golf Tournament, which Pinckney said contributes nothing to the black city. On hand for the protests was Marion Kramer, head of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization and widow of the legendary Detroit activist General Gordon Baker.
I am happy to be here and to see that this man is alive and yes. Still alive. Because for several years, I'm going to take a rest with my family. Yeah. I get out there and Dorothy's calling. I said, what didn't happen? They done picked up Reverend Pinckney. I said, oh my God, I can't go nowhere without him having power. But I was so happy here in the beginning, having the opportunity to come up here, like Sylvia said, and join this particular campaign that you were having in Benton Harbor about the injustice against poor people, be you white, bright, be you white, blue, green, or whatever. Reverend Pinckney was out there along with Dorothy on the picket line, if it was necessary, by himself, fighting against the injustice in Benton Harbor and the city surrounding it. So, you know, I've been proud to be a person on this line. And my husband, before he died, he was quite concerned about what is happening up here. And every time he came up here, all we saw was Detroit, Highland Park, and the rest of the country. You know, but they constantly try to split us up. But I want to let you know, by you being here today and to see all those young women, because of the fact that you have lost your children and what have you, those were our children also.
That's right.
And you know, we have a couple, you know, we're at war here. Right. They talk about the war on the international level, right. But there is war going on here, because every time they shoot one of us or one of our children,
right.
They make some money off those bullets.
Right.
And that's at our expense.
Yeah.
Don't sit back and wait for someone else to liberate you. You got to, when you join this movement, you got to stay in this movement. We got to fight that we end up not only coming up and out of poverty. When you talk about coming out of poverty, I know welfare rights, we've been talking about coming up and out of poverty and fighting that for years. But when you talk about doing it and move to try to do it, you got to go straight up against this government, because poverty is a tool that they use to constantly split the section of the working class.
Yeah.
And we got to understand who is the real enemy. The enemy is not that nut that we hear and see it in Washington, D.C.
Right.
He's representing his class. We're representing our class today. Our class is all these young people that are getting killed out here and don't realize what they're being killed for, because they're the next generation to be able to be that necessary army to bring all of us up and out of poverty. And they're trying to get rid of it. It's been over 23 schools that have been shot up. 23 schools. Can you imagine what would happen if those families began to see that they need to be with the people not only in Benton Harbor, or be with the people in the metropolitan area of Detroit and throughout Michigan, how much this army will grow. Then if they don't see it, we got to go see them.
That's right.
Because they need to be right here with us. And I tell you one thing that I'm through. When they said in court, the last time, I mean, they put him in jail, that they don't need no evidence to put someone in Benton Harbor in prison. They weren't just talking about Reverend Pinckney. They were talking about all of us. All of us. Can you imagine being in your bed at night and they knock on the door and say, I'm coming to get you? For what? You walked across the street illegally. They are changing the laws to protect themselves, to be able to do all this fracking out here, to be able to do what the hell they want and privatize our water, and to hell with us. You don't know how much, when you drink that, you know, we a lot of time, we get tired of it, but we still do it. When you drink this, what is it, Mountain Dew water, Ice Mountain. That's Nestle's.
Mm-hmm.
Nestle's was put out of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
From having that same type of water. The people took together and got them out of there. Nestle, get sweat off every day and actually get paid from this state every day because they don't have to pay a lot of the taxes and what have you that way. They get paid for donating water to people that need water. Like, you know, Nestle is one of the reasons why Flint is the way it is today. Right in Highland Park, they just announced 2 weeks ago that the children have lead. And some of the people want to always go in and educate the mayor. He said, well, do you know what that is, Mary? And that's lead in the windows. And so I said, damn fool, no, it's not. Excuse me. No, it's not. It's when somebody's water is off in your community, that's going to affect you. Because when those pipes are reopened, all that stuff goes to your house and everybody else's house.
Right.
So we, you know, I know we're in a setback a lot of time and didn't want to deal with, what was facing us out here. Well, if not, you're going to be the next person that we're going to have to bury because of the lack of water, because of what is going on. Either we're going to fight for the next generation or we're going to die just sitting around saying they're going to take care of it. Yeah, they're going to take care of it. They're going to take care of it. And we need to stand up and take care of them and let them know this is our country. We're going to take this country, and damn it, if you do wrong, then we don't need no evidence, Reverend Pickens, to put that behind what we need to do.
That was Marion Kramer of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization in Benton Harbor, Michigan.
Recently, the world learned that as many as 5,000 Puerto Ricans died in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. Far more than originally thought. Now a new report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington shows that the appointed financial board that oversees Puerto Rico finances has been trying to divert disaster relief aid to finance the island's debt. We spoke with Lara Merlin, one of the authors of that report.
Instead of using all the relief fund, and Puerto Rico is not even getting as much in relief funds as they need and should be getting to sort of rebuild as much as possible. They're still trying to put money aside for the surplus that can be claimed by bondholders. So it's really hard to believe that there's really extra money lying around in Puerto Rico that's not really needed for other things that just could be used for that. And at the same time, their plan and budget wants to cut more from essential services. So they want to cut more from healthcare spending, education spending, and all sorts of other public services to just put this money aside for a surplus.
Isn't this outrageous? We have an island lying in ruins with possibly 5,000 unaccounted dead, and people are considering paying off the bankers.
It is, but as you said, the board is not democratically elected and they're not particularly invested in the humanitarian situation in Puerto Rico. So to them, the extra cash is just extra cash to be moved around and pay financial obligations.
What kind of mechanisms stand in the way of them paying off the bankers instead of putting that money to more humanitarian uses?
Well, so whatever money they get from the government for something specific, they can't really just take the money and pay debt. But what they do is they take the funds that were previously allocated to pay for certain things like healthcare or certain rebuilding efforts. And whatever was already budgeted for that, they take away and put towards debt payment and then just put the federal funds to that use, rather than using the federal funds as like extra money to be able to do more to help.
You're the author of a report that takes a broad look at the workings of the Puerto Rican government and elected officials and their response to the hurricane and its aftermath and now these predations by the board.
Yeah, so in this report we actually just released today, we looked at the plan and like what exactly it does. And we just see that it's just a plan that proposes to cut everything. It uses a lot of euphemisms. It says savings and transformations, but it just means cuts. And there's this promise that maybe from all these cuts, the economy will magically recover, but it most likely won't. And it will just continue to punish people by cutting things they need.
What kind of grassroots resistance to this kind of misgovernance are we seeing in Puerto Rico? And can we compare that to the response of elected officials in Puerto Rico?
The response of some elected officials in Puerto Rico hasn't been that great. So there was a previous version of this plan certified 2 weeks ago that had slightly more cuts, and the governor negotiated to save a few things that were no longer cut. But then looking at it closely, we also noticed that in the negotiation, the governor also saved his own office and legislature from some of the cuts, while the savings he got for the rest of the people were pretty modest. So we sort of gave in to the demands of the board to also just save his own office from more budget cuts. And when I mean his own, it's just actually the administrative expense of his office and legislature.
Well, there are all kinds of speculative entrepreneurs circling around Puerto Rico, talking about turning it into a new hub for this kind or that kind of enterprise, including exotic currencies and such. But you seem to be painting a picture of an economy that has been abandoned by the public sector.
Yes, and sadly, that has been the current governor's approach in Puerto Rico, rather than trying to rebuild from the bottom up and help the people who live there and the longtime residents and help them. His strategy has been to become attractive to these outside investors and offer them sort of tax deals and other incentives to move there, even though none of them would really move there and create any type of good jobs for the people already there, especially those that are in the field of cryptocurrencies or things that aren't really tangible and don't produce anything or create any jobs.
Puerto Rico has been losing population for some time, but about how many people do folks believe have left since the hurricane? And what is the effect of such population losses?
No one knows exactly how many people left since the hurricane, because a lot of people left with the intention of maybe returning, but they probably won't if things don't get better with the economy. And that is the result. As the more people leave, the less of a labor force there is, the less of an economy there is, the less of people who can pay taxes. And it's kind of a downward spiral. The worse the economy gets, more people leave, and then the economy just worsens.
We keep on hearing about imminent privatizations in Puerto Rico, which is what we hear on the mainland and through much of the Western world as well.
That has sort of been also the model of this disaster capitalism idea, where people are now so down and have so many problems they're dealing with after the storm that they don't have the energy to fight back against these measures. And it makes it really easy to just sell off public assets to private entities that don't really have the public interest at heart, but just want to make money. So by privatizing electricity, yeah, you could say that maybe that's a way to fix the grid, but then whoever buys it, they want to make money. They're not interested in providing everyone on the island with reliable and cheap power. So actually, as Puerto Rico's own experience in the past showed, they've tried to privatize water twice in a row, and it didn't go very well for them. The private companies made a lot of money, but then in the end, the government had to take the water authority back, and it was in worse shape than when they gave it to the hands of private contractors.
And they're talking about privatizing the grid.
Yes, and the grid is one of Puerto Rico's main problems. It's really old, it's really outdated. Electricity is very expensive and very unreliable. so it needs to be fixed. But rather than using maybe federal funds that they're getting to just rebuild it and fix it and keep it in public hands to make sure that all these improvements and the efficiencies from these improvements go back to the people of Puerto Rico, if you sell it, it just means that someone else will make profits off of the people living there. One of the selling points trying to find someone to buy the grid is that people living there are already used to expensive energy prices. So it's going to be very easy to charge them a lot.
What would be a decent public response, just a decent response to the myriad problems that Puerto Rico faces right now? Some of the problems involving the hurricane, but other problems that were more longstanding.
A decent response would be a lot more federal relief support that would go towards public investment of fixing the damaged infrastructure without selling any of it off, and also taking away so much power from this board that also clearly has no experience dealing with any type of disaster relief, and coming up with a way in which maybe Puerto Ricans can democratically elect their own government, or not have this outside authority make these decisions for them.
And who is empowered to disempower the board?
Well, U.S. Congress is who elected and named the board. And we already know that Puerto Ricans are not represented in U.S. Congress. So they should maybe, even if they had some representation in Congress, it would help a little in having a say in what the board can or cannot do.
That was Lara Merlin of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, says the United States now appears to have a king in charge, Donald the First.
In a formally secret letter to the Office of Special Prosecutor, Robert Mueller, counsel for the U.S. president argued that he, President Trump, had the inherent power to, if need be, pardon himself. The argument is a stunning one, but it's been coming since Election Day. Trump and his lawyers have essentially embraced the argument advanced by former President Richard Nixon, who, in an interview with the late David Frost, argued, when a president does it, it's legal. Watergate cast that idea into the trash can of history. Until now, presidents, like kings, are above the law. In 1974, the Supreme Court ruled in United States versus Nixon, as in Richard Nixon, the president, that no one, not even the president of the United States, is above the law. But King Donald I heeds another law, the law of power, the law of privilege, the law of wealth. You think he or his lawyers give a fig about the Supreme Court? They serve King Donald, and he serves himself. Imagine the scene. I, Donald Trump, hereby pardons Donald Trump. Signed, Donald Trump. We are in a madhouse, one of America's own making. The King Donald Trump Show, live.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal reporting from the Pennsylvania prison gulag.
Black bookstores are disappearing at an alarming rate. In Harlem, New York, Jennifer Wilson operates the Sisters Uptown Bookstore and Culture Center. She told Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier why she opened a bookstore in Black America's most famous neighborhood.
My basic influence came from the elders in the community because they had organized tenant associations in this community so that buildings can become organized and purchase their buildings and self-manage. So my building was one of the buildings that was in the program. So we actually purchased our building, and we were fortunate enough to have three commercial spaces. So I was following suit and on assignment from the elders in the community because they brought me along with them. And they told me that they were passing the torch to me But to know that years later there was going to be an energy that was going to come to take it, to move it forward, to take the community from us and all the spaces. So my efforts became directed at putting my energies into community, because one of the main things they said to me is community of self is essential. And so I came from that also. My family migrated from the South, my dad, to New York City. And when I grew up, the depiction that I had was all of the folk in the community had their own businesses, be it barbershop, beauty parlor, floral shops, funeral parlors, whatever was needed in the community, it was owned and operated by community folks. So there was a community of self, the community was supported, and so I grew up in that. And so it was innate in me to start that effort in the community where I lived. So we had, in my co-op building, three commercial spaces. Most of them had closed, and so it came to me. I said to the board of directors, why don't we do a food co-op, or, you know, just start some businesses of our own in those spaces since they belong to the building. Well, folk were like, oh, it's going to take too much work, and, you know, who's going to go buy the food or whatever? So I decided to just canvass the community and see what was not here and what was really needed. And we didn't have a bookstore south or west of, at that point we were called Sugar Hill. It was Upper Harlem. And so the bookstores were basically in the lower part of Harlem. 135th Street was the Liberation Bookstore, ran by Miss Una, which has since closed and she's transitioned. And then years prior, there was the Tree of Life, which was on 125th Street. There was a bookstore in the 125 Mart, ran by a lady named Isis. And then there was a bookstore on 94th Street and Amsterdam Avenue called Black Books Plus. But there was no bookstores uptown. So it just came to mind that we should have a bookstore up here. And also, growing up in Georgia in the South, I never saw any depiction of anybody that looked like me in a book. There just weren't books with black folk in them. And so I grew up feeling like a little invisible girl because I didn't know who I was from whence I came, didn't see pictures. And so it was in my spirit and my soul to have a space that housed and presented our history, past, present, and future. And so it became initially Sisters Uptown Bookstore. So we found that initially it was very, very difficult, didn't have a lot of books in the store, but it took perseverance because I could hear the ancestors and the elders saying, we got your back. If we assign you, we got you, so you can do this. So day in and day out, constantly trying to figure out ways to increase resources and population or whatever, we started seeing the arts. There were a lot of artists and musicians in this community, and this community is rich with that part of our culture. Sugar Hill was known for musicians and professionals and all of that history, and writers and artists. So all of that history is right here. So in 2007, we opened January 2000, and in June of 2007, I think it was, we added the cultural center component to just enhance and then bring in more people to the store via events. And so that worked because we sustain ourselves basically now because we have events. We have monthly book clubs where folk come and choose a book a month and they come and discuss it. There's one group that meets there about, they have a core group of about 25, 30 women. So that's a big day for us because they're all buying their books from us. We give a discount. So those are big days. Then we have sound meditation. We have the African Folk Heritage Circle who come and tell stories. We have a poetry writer's workshop, and after that they do some open mic. And then we have signings. So, you know, local authors, everybody's writing books now, so we get at least 5 submissions a week, so authors. And so it's just those things that help to build the true essence of the bookstore and cultural center.
And of those community events that you've had over the years since 2007, are there any highlights that come to mind now that you would like to share with us?
Well, all of them. I mean, because there's an energy in that space that it's just not a bookstore. It's actually a place where we can come, and it's a safe haven. People come and exchange information and ideals. They have the, you know, the parameters are removed, and we can just be free to talk about what we need to talk about that's going on in the community and current events in our communities throughout the universe freely. We don't have to, you know, look around and can't speak about this or whatever. You can speak freely. And, you know, it gets controversial because everybody thinks differently about where we are and what's going on in the world today. So, but we can do that in an environment where you're not attacked for what you think. It's, you know, there's a freedom in the space that people like where they can just be who they are and speak it out, because we can't, you can't do that everywhere. So I embrace every energy that comes through, be it a book signing or poetry event or whatever. We had a couple of years ago, I think it was October 2016, when Dr. Joy DeGroy, people know her as Joy Leary, but now she's Dr. Joy Leary DeGroy, came and spoke on post-traumatic slave syndrome. And the place was actually just packed, because that is where we are today. And so folk, the conscious community, came out, because she is just profound in the simplicity of her presentation on post-traumatic slave syndrome. It was just amazing. So that I'll never, ever forget. And then, you know, we've had a number of people that have come through that, the impact from who they are and the humbleness that they still have. Because some folk, you know, who said what we call made it, are not attainable. You know, we can't reach them because we don't have enough money to pay for their expenses and whatever. But there's some folk who are still grassroots who will come if there's a vineyard, don't require anything. So it's those folk that I love to work with and love that they come and merge their energy in the space. So that was one profound meeting of the minds that we've had in the store. And then the sound meditation. The sound from the gong is earthbound. It's connected to the earth. So those sounds that are being permeated in that space into our energy is from the earth and the universe. So to me, that's profound. Everything that happens there, every organization that comes with a purpose that permeates that space and that already ancestral energy that's there is special. So everybody that comes brings something to the table. See, I'm not, because people say, oh, you know, why you don't have any big name, you know, people coming through or whatever. The people that come are the ones that are supposed to come. See, I'm not caught up in glim and glamour and names and whatever. I do work with whoever wants to do work. So that's the energy in the space. That's my energy. So whoever comes and that's reachable, that's who I work with.
The Atlantic published an article called The FBI's War on Black-Owned Bookstores. As the last remaining owner of a bookstore of African descent in Manhattan, do you think that these kinds of forces are specifically targeting and attempting to undermine independent ownership of bookstores by people who look like us?
Most definite. If you check, about 5 years ago, there were at least about 300 black-owned bookstores. If you check today, there was a list that said there were about 52, 54. That number has diminished because the last two in Brooklyn closed over the last few months. And then I had a brother who has a family black-owned card store who said all of his stores are closed. He had two in Brooklyn, one on White Plains Road in the Bronx, and then he just had one in Yonkers, and they all closed. And he said he took that list of black-owned bookstores, and he's called. He said he doesn't even think it's 50 left because he called all the numbers, and most of them are disconnected, or they've changed from bookstores and become something else, some other kind of variety store or whatever. In my mind, it may be 50 or less. And so to me, that seems to be a concerted effort to make sure we don't exist. And I find that the rents are also a major, major issue. They call it gentrification. I call it colonization, because if you check our history, some years ago, we ended up having to migrate from the South and all the other areas that we migrated to Chicago, to Detroit, New York City, New Jersey. That's where all the blacks were migrating to. If you think about it and you check our history, it is a repeat. This is not gentrification, it's colonization, and the history is being repeated. We're being displaced because the formula that was thought of 30 years ago is now in practice in terms of, okay, they can go wherever they can go because now we're going to reclaim those spaces. They didn't buy, they didn't, you know, they don't own, or even if they own, we're going to repurchase those spaces from them. And then they can go wherever they can find a place to live. That's where they'll go. So, yeah, there is a concerted effort to make sure that black-owned bookstores or independent bookstores owned by black folk don't exist, because that's where our history is. And we're not connected to it. We're not connected to supporting what we have, and I think that was done deliberately in terms of where we've come from and where we're going, because we don't care who we purchase from. If there's something that we see that we want, we'll buy it. We're some of the largest consumers that exist, and I think all of that was deliberate also. Just spend your money. Our money didn't stay in our community more than 6 hours. There are other folk, other groups, their money is in their community for 30 days, for however many days or whatever, but our money didn't stay in our community longer than 6 hours. So to answer your question, yes, there is a concerted effort to undo independent, and it's not just independent bookstores, it's just independent businesses, period, that are owned by, because think about it, look around, what do we own? We don't own our own schools, we don't own our own this, we don't, you know, you think about, what do we own? And then you think about, you work on your job until you're 60, now they're trying to increase the age to 70, for what? So to me, the true essence of that concerted effort is valid, brother. It's very valid. And if enough of us don't wake up and figure this thing out, we will become extinct in terms of ownership, black-owned bookstores. That's where our history and our culture is. The ancestors have already left the information for us. It's there. But we don't embrace it. And we don't even support the places where the information lies. So I'm always thinking and dreaming and trying to figure out ways to keep it moving forward. So that's been my plight. And then also making sure that it's a legacy so that it is preserved and it'll always be. Once I transition and not there anymore, it will still stand, is what needs to happen. How that happens, it's a whole nother story, whether or not there's a community to support that, but that's my ideology of that institution? Because it's an institution, it's not just a bookstore or culture center. That bookstore is an institution, because to sustain for 18 years. And I know I'm on the list.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.